A podcast of the cinema.
And oily cakes.
And oily cakes.
I'm going to make... Oh, yeah.
Were you inspired?
I'm going to be making a couple of those.
Okay.
A couple dozen of those.
Because, you know, you could also...
Powdered sugar them up.
if you're going to make those, you could make churros.
Right. Yes. To my everlasting shame... The churrero. I can't even pronounce that word.
Yes.
There's too many R's in it, and I can't make a Spanish R.
The churro machine.
The churro pusher outer Play-Doh Fun Factory thingy that we bought in Spain. Was it in 2014? That was when
it was when
Young Rod got married.
Yes, that's when.
So it was 24. So okay, so 6 years.
Yes,
have passed. My name's Dave White, by the way. I am a film critic. I used to write for The Wrap, but then a virus came along, and no one has a job anymore. Also, there's Alonzo Duralde.
Yes.
He is my husband. He also used to write for The Wrap, but then a virus came, and nobody has a job anymore. He was also the film reviews editor of that site.
I like to think that one day I will be again.
They called it a furlough for you.
Yes.
And you know, it's been 4 months of furloughing.
Things are tough all over.
Dude. They certainly are. But, you know, that's what's happening.
Yes.
Anyway, this is a podcast about reviewing movies that we do every week of the current cinema. And sometimes films that came out at the very beginning of March and then quickly stopped being in movie theaters because a virus came along. And that I just finally got around to watching today.
Yes.
What a weird... We're just going to get right into the movies, by the way, because...
Well, you're in the middle of a thought. About...
Hang on. We're just going to get right in the middle of the movie. We're just going to get right into the movies today. With only some ridiculous digressions about churro makers. We were there for yours, mine, and ours.
Yes.
Nephew, wedding, and we went to the fancy cookware shop that was recommended to us by a chef friend.
Yes.
And then I bought the churro maker because the churros in Spain and the churros... in Southern California are different.
Yes.
They're not big in Spain. They're small.
Yeah.
And you dunk them into that hot chocolate.
Mm.
And we went to a churro place. We went to a different churro place every single day.
Yes.
While we were there, including the one that's like 200 years old or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And has been open for 24 hours a day for like 200 years.
Like the
I don't know if it's 200 years old, but it's super old. It's well over 100 years old.
The Spain churro is not the kind of churro that you get at like Disneyland.
No.
Which is like one long, you know...
Thing. Long and big.
Yeah.
But the ones in Spain are smaller and thinner, and you dunk them in the chocolate.
Yeah.
Oh. Mm. Ah. Well, anyway, I bought this thing. Like you do when you're out on vacation in a foreign land
with
where
big
all
dreams.
Your... You know, you're there. There's like 100 Duraldes in Spain, and they're all just like, hey, what are we going to do? And we're like, nothing with y'all today. We've been around you for too many days in a row. And now we're going to go to this fancy restaurant place and then eat some more churros. And I bought the churro maker. It has not even come out of the box. Every time I open the cabinet where it lives, I look at it and go, shame on you. Shame on you,
oh,
Dave
you.
White, for not making the bold decision to learn to use it.
Well, it's a deep fry thing.
Frightening.
We'll have to boil the kitchen when it's done. Because
yeah.
The splatter is going to be
it's
off
a very
the
well. We have a splatter guard for the
still.
That will not be a problem.
Okay.
It's just that I don't know. Sometimes I'm super adventurous.
Yes.
And I want to try a new thing and go make a new thing. And in fact, I do that a lot.
It's true. You do.
All you have to do is introduce a gadget into the mix. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I become...
It's true. The Instant Pot still has its own room.
The Instant Pot is frightening to me. We've used it a couple times, but I still am freaking out every time I touch it. So anyway, churros are the same thing, essentially,
yes,
as the oily cake in the film First Cow,
yes,
which I bought a ticket to see, as did you, on March 2nd or 3rd?
No, and that, well, Mark. You bought it on the... Yes, sorry.
And then... The screening was opening night, Thursday, March 5th.
Yes.
And I became so sick.
Yes.
So sick in a strange way that we still don't quite understand and don't know what it was. Yeah. But it lasted for like 10 days, and
Did you have it?
I don't know. Because you can drive to Dodger Stadium and sit for 3 hours in your car and wait for a test, but even that won't tell you if you had it.
Only if you currently have it.
And so...
I have lived with you for 25 years.
You've never seen it like that.
I have never seen it like this. You had to sleep sitting up like 3 or 4 days.
Because I couldn't breathe when I lied. While
your
I was lying
your
down.
Lungs would fill up with things.
Yeah.
So this was different.
It was. In a way that when I think of it, I think, oh, what was that?
Yeah.
You know, and then it went away.
Yeah.
Like I didn't, by the time it was over, by the time I was finished with it, that was when everything was locking down.
Closed,
and I thought, wait, did I just have this thing?
Was I an early adopter without meaning to?
And my first thought was, at least I am at home and doing well, you know. But see, here's the weirdest part. The friend that I was hanging out with like 3 or 4 days before, is the person who went to see First Cow with you instead of me that night.
Yeah.
He didn't get sick.
No.
You didn't get sick.
No.
And so who knows? Anyway, First Cow, they were holding on to it like Tenet. They were going to be like, no, we're going to release it this fall for awards consideration. And rightly so.
Right.
I must say.
Yeah. Well, they opened it in early March, you know, and everything was all set to go. Did it premiere at Sundance? Do we know? I forget.
Who knows?
I think it did. Or Berlin or one of those. And I did, this was the last movie I saw in a theater in the before time on March 5th. But yeah, then when, you know, opening a week later was never, rarely, sometimes, always.
Right.
And they very quickly bit the bullet and were like, okay, theatrical's not happening. $20 rental. We're going to stream this thing.
Is that how much that cost?
That was, yeah.
$20.
That was a 20 bucker.
A 20 bucker.
But A24 for First Cow was like, no. This is what we're going to ride this out. We're going to come back to the theaters. You can just see this in
the curve shall be flattened.
Yes.
For cinema.
Surely this, the greatest country on earth, can quash.
When was the last time you heard anyone call the United States the greatest country on earth?
Well, you know.
Anyone who's not a dumbass.
Well, I was
right wing.
Okay, thank you.
Jerk. Okay.
It's been a while.
All right.
It's been a while since I don't know if we ever deserved it, but we don't deserve it.
Newsflash, we've never deserved it.
No.
And we are not it currently by a fur piece.
Look, we did the Marshall Plan, and we walked on the moon.
Okay.
There were some highlights in there.
There were a few.
Now is not one of them.
We invented Oreos.
And now everybody else is going to get to see Tenet first, and that's what we get.
That's what you get.
That's right. Oh, you don't want to wear a mask? Fine. Everybody else gets to see Tenet before you. Hope you're happy.
So
this was a weird thing where I wound up seeing First Cow before you, and you...
In the Arclight Movie Theater.
In the Arclight Movie Theater. But,
and then they closed.
Yeah,
like
exactly
right away,
very quickly,
right after that.
But you are the massive fan of Kelly Reichardt.
I am
a great admirer as well. But it's just always weird. It's like when I got to see, you know, Cemetery of Splendor before you did. It just that makes
still,
no sense in the
it
universe.
It still makes me angry that happened. Like, I think it's unfair to this day that you did, and I resent you.
Well, I went to Sundance and you didn't. What can
for
I say?
It. I don't resent you going to Sundance,
see,
though.
See, that's
place,
the payoff.
That just seems like a nightmare.
I got
even
to
under
see,
good circumstances.
I saw certain women before you did because I saw it at Sundance.
Most film festivals seem like nightmares to me.
It's, you know.
I
you're not a crowd person.
Back in the
day.
That's
an issue.
Back in the day when I lived in Dallas and you were the king boss daddy of the USA Film Festival, which, you know, used to be a film festival that I totally enjoyed going to when I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
And would seek out, not a film critic at the time, just a civilian enthusiast.
Yes.
I would seek out, you know,
cinephile.
Derek Jarman's Blue when y'all screened it there.
That was before me, but yes.
Yeah. You probably had a hand in that, didn't you?
I don't think they needed help from me on that one. I think that at the time it was, you know.
You know, things like that. Because I was a super next level film goer.
It's funny though. You're now making me think about movies I need to go track down. Like,
what?
Is Odile and Yvette at the End of the World streaming anywhere?
Does
anyone remember that movie?
Well, considering that it was a regional Texas film,
yeah,
had a strangely surreal Selena Julie go boating vibe all about it, including
the title.
It was clearly influenced by that film.
Yeah.
And there were 7 other people in the screening the day I went. And I don't think that guy ever made another movie.
Oh, wow.
So probably not out there.
Oh, wow.
But if you directed and wrote Odile and Yvette at the End of the World, I liked it.
Yeah, it was
a
good.
Lot.
I programmed it.
That back in the day of then.
Speaking of Dallas films, did I tell you that Late Bloomers is streaming on Tubi?
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm being ridiculous when I say I'm super next level anything. Just FYI, in case this is your
first new listeners, yes,
episode. I don't think that of myself, or much really of myself, and so
at the edge of the world.
At the edge of the world. That's right. The edge. Sorry, dude, who directed Odile and Yvette at the Edge of the World. I know you're out there, hearing me.
And actually, he is not. He's dead.
He died?
He died in 2007 at the age of 47.
No
which
way!
Is really sad.
Oh, that's terrible.
And that is the only film that he wrote and directed.
Oh.
But now I hope it's out there somewhere because it was really charming.
It was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so First Cow.
Yes.
It is about a man in the Pacific Northwest who is the cook for a band of, you know, gold seekers.
And occasional fur trappers.
And occasional fur trappers, thank you. And they treat him terribly.
Yes.
and then they abandon him, and he's kind of on his own. Played by John Magaro.
Yes.
And he is in the woods one day foraging for you know, nuts, berries, mushrooms, squirrels, whatever they can, you know, get their hands on to cook. And he runs into a naked Chinese man. And they become friends. And the naked man is played by Orion Lee, who I don't know. I don't know John Magaro either. These guys are both new to me.
Yeah, John Magaro is like, it's like Christian Milioti from Palm Springs, where they've been in stuff that I've seen, but
John Magaro has been in a few things, and Orion Lee has been in a million things, and I actually have seen some of the stuff he's been in.
John Magaro was in Carol and The Big Short, but I don't remember him in those movies.
It takes me, this is something I learned while watching The Old Guard today, because Kiki Layne
yes.
is in The Old Guard. and I was introduced to Kiki Layne via If Beale Street Could Talk. She's the lead.
Yeah.
But for the first 15 minutes of Old Guard, looking at her face, I was like, do I know you? I know you somehow. I know you from something. Pause the movie. Go look her up. And I was like, oh, so it takes me like six movies to learn a face.
Well, especially if they're going to, like, I mean, Kiki Layne goes from being this sort of, she is shot like an old school, you know, starlet almost in,
right,
in Beale Street Could Talk. It's
right,
all soft edges and,
right,
you know, and then she is a Marine who will, like, who will snap your neck
she
in
will kill
5
you.
Seconds
yeah.
in the new movie. So, yeah, so it's the carryover is tricky.
Anyway, they meet and they become friends.
Yes.
And when John Magaro's character, his name is Otis, and
Figowitz, but everybody calls him Cookie.
Everyone calls him Cookie, and Orion Lee's character's name is King Lou. When they find themselves sort of apart from each other, they learn that a rich British person is in the area and has brought a cow over,
yes,
to the Pacific Northwest, the very first one.
Hence the title.
And the reason he has the cow is because he wants milk in his tea.
Yes.
If I were a rich person of that era and I needed milk in my tea, I too would have a cow brought over somehow.
Yes. This is a this is
because
a very,
I do need milk in my tea
this
in
is
the morning.
A, this is a very dairy based film, and I relate to the characters for that.
So there's the cow.
Yes.
And they start stealing the milk
in the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night, so that they can make little cakes and things to sell.
Yes.
To very hungry miners and trappers,
who've been eating hardtack for months.
They've been eating all sorts of terrible ration type food.
Yeah. And Cookie is a cow whisperer.
Yeah, he loves, like, that cow.
He has very beautiful conversations with the cow and puts the, yeah, cow at ease and is able to, like, get her to give milk. That, I'll tell you, we talked about, you know, one of our Patreon shows, Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife. We recently talked about Orlando and Tilda, yeah, Swinton's admiration of the acting of the donkey in Robert Bresson's O Hussard Balthazar.
Right.
This cow
this
gives that donkey
good.
A run for its money.
The cow is, she's a beautiful cow.
Yes. Very expressive eyes.
She has beautiful eyes. And when he touches her on her side and says, "Hello, how are you today?" She turns and looks at him like, "Oh, hello, you are my friend." You, yes, know, like, it's very much this very gentle
rapport.
Yeah. And I won't spoil what happens, but if you think about it, if you've got the only cow in town,
yes,
and someone starts making cakes, and if you put two and two together, of where'd you get the milk for that cake that you just made that everyone loves so much that
King Lu keeps saying ancient Chinese.
He literally says this. And
which just cements that line as the thing you say to stupid white people.
Pretty much. Yeah. But that's just the plot.
Yes.
And in a Kelly Reichardt film, plot is not all.
Right.
You know, if you told your friend, "Oh, you should go see this movie about a guy who steals milk so he can make cakes."
Yes.
They would look at you and they would say, why would I do that? Why would I go see that movie?
Also, a Kelly Reichardt movie may be period, but it is always about
right now.
Yeah.
What you get in this film is a deep, quiet, gentle examination of what can friendship between two assuming heterosexual men
ostensibly
be like. All right. Because that seems to have been lost, that kind of intimacy and that kind of caring and the idea of, you know, really looking out for someone, really making someone, you know, your partner without the queer baggage that goes along with that word in a contemporary setting.
There is a school of thought that the existence, the public existence and acknowledgement of homosexuality has somehow tainted men's friendships because they are so constantly worried, straight men are so constantly worried about being mistaken for being gay that they do not allow themselves intimacy in the most, like, you know, casual, platonic, friendly ways.
And before you write us, we would like to say, not all straight men.
Yes, hashtag. many straight men out there can give and take a bro hug.
I have wonderful, beautiful straight male friends who love me and tell me they love me and are not afraid of all of that.
Yes. And I think this is a thing that thankfully is slowly starting to go away, in that we see a younger generation that doesn't care about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that Andy Samberg can have a joke in Palm Springs, it's not even a joke, really, just the event
well, it's played for laughs, but it's also not played for homophobia.
Exactly.
Which is a fine line to walk, but that Palm Springs accomplishes that in that little throwaway moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, this is a thing of two men who are allowed to be close and intimate and caring. And it's sort of like when you look back at, you know, that clip of Wings that they always show in, like, the celluloid closet of, like, you know, war buddies hugging each other and crying on each other's shoulders and taking care of each other.
Right.
And it being admired by, like, the woman who loves one or both of them.
Right.
You know, as a sign of, like, how great this friendship is.
In a very real way, this is the somewhat less melancholy, I put an asterisk by that word.
Somewhat or melancholy?
Melancholy.
Okay.
Version of an early Kelly Reichardt film called Old Joy, about two young guys, two young adult friends who go on one final camping trip together because they realize they're growing apart as they age. And they think maybe somehow this camping trip will reconnect them. But they spend the entire weekend kind of understanding that it's not going to.
Hmm.
And there is physical touching in that film, which back when it came out in the early, like, 2000s, you know, even that was, people were looking at that like, oh, is this gay? And you're like, no. And so, I say somewhat less melancholy. There is a sense of melancholy that pervades this entire film simply because of plot elements and because of the very nature of male-male friendships and what has been lost over time. I want to clarify what you said earlier, though, about homosexuality and the open discussion of it tainting, you know, the idea of a male friendship that isn't gay.
Mm-hmm.
That word, tainting, is something that comes directly from the straight guys themselves.
Right.
Like,
I
we didn't
quotes.
Do anything except...
Yes. Exist.
Except finally exist and say we exist.
Yeah.
No,
we're awesome. Okay, on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Let's not get wild here. But in the end, what this film is I was going to say a word that began with a re something, but it's not a re anything. It's a request to imagine what the world could be like again if men could turn off their alpha nonsense.
Mm, let down their guard.
Yeah.
And it's also, I think, about resources and exploitation.
It is also about those other things. It is about exploitation. It's about capitalism. It's about who got the stuff and who has to do whatever they can to get by to get their little piece of it. You know, who came to a place and, you know, wrecked it for the people who were already there.
Right. You know, like who is the real criminal, you know, and like when does the criminal reach in a capitalist society reach a level of respectability at which point, you know, they are no longer called one, even if they still are.
Yeah. This is a lovely, lovely movie. It is quiet, which is just one of my favoritest things. And
you like your music noisy and your films quiet.
That's right. I contain many, I'm a multifaceted jewel.
You are.
Yeah. I love this film. It's one of the best things I've seen all year.
No question.
Little aside, I don't want to give him a lot of oxygen, or really any, but Armand White is an asshole. And you can bleep me if you want to, but I had to say that word out loud.
Okay.
He is a film critic for, I don't even know who anymore.
The National Review.
And he's notorious for being, you know,
ridiculously contrarian.
Ridiculously contrarian. But he wrote such a wrong-headed and nasty review of this film that I read after watching, and
I refused. And
I had to see what it was, because he's not just an intentionally incendiary wrong-headed writer. He's also a bad person. He has done bad things in public at awards dinners.
Yes.
He called Parkland shooting survivors crisis actors.
Yes.
He's like gross.
Yeah, he's a troll.
And so there you go. I just had to say it. I know that by saying it and drawing attention to him, he gets more air. But he made me angry, and I don't like you. You're a bad man, and I don't care if you are my queer brother.
Mm.
He is, but I don't care.
Yeah.
See what you said? You said earlier we were awesome.
That's why I said...
He's not.
Yes. Again, case-by-case basis.
That's all. This is a beautiful film.
Yes.
This is a beautiful film.
And circling back to Kiki Lane, let's talk about The Old Guard.
Yes. Well.
See, I wanted you to see it before we talked about it.
I wasn't, like, dragging my feet. I just didn't have a minute.
Sure, no, you know. I get it.
I think you'll take note of my recent Instagram post of the strawberry pandowdy I made. I was busy.
That was so good.
Yeah, it's still in the fridge.
I know.
Have you had it cold yet?
No.
I'm going to tell you something.
Ooh. Okay.
It's nice. It's nice cold.
Great.
It was nice hot out of the oven.
Mm-hmm.
Someone on Instagram asked me if I take commissions. I said, I do now.
It was
friend Daniel, actually, who asked.
I'm
being all mysterious.
It's not the guy from the movie asking you to make a clafouti.
Toby Jones asking me to make a clafouti for him? No, but I would. No, he said, are you taking commissions? He was joking.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, I am unemployed.
Talk to me.
So
ask my agent.
If you're local and you want to come
get it lowered in the
LA Dodgers bucket from our, just put the cash in the bucket and I'll send down the baked treat. And
I was talking
I might be a business now. Who knows?
You're a businessman. Mm-hmm. I was talking about the bucket to my Who Shot You co-host, and they immediately took it to the Silence of the Lambs place.
What?
And I'm like, no, the bucket is for Swiss Family Robinson.
Minus the racism.
Yes.
But and the misogyny.
That also. But it's wholesome and uplifting. It's not putting the lotion in the basket.
No.
Stop it.
It's friends come over and friends who don't want to touch our security gate and friends who don't want to navigate our stairwell. And, because let me tell you, we got some neighbors who don't wear masks.
No.
So I don't blame them for not wanting
Indeed
to.
Indeed not.
Margie. Margie came up with the big idea of the bucket, and we just thought it was a wonderful thing.
So, like, if people...
She brought us the bucket.
If people come over and they've got, like,
the big 5-gallon L.A. Dodgers bucket. Yeah.
People that got produce in their garden they want to share with us, we bring it up in the bucket. And if we've got extra limes or something, then we put them in the bucket and lower them down.
Gary Cotty, get some limes.
Yes.
But, yeah, I don't know. Commissions on baked treats. Who wants to... Talk to me. Who wants to pay me some money?
Time to start that Venmo account.
I got PayPal. Is that not good enough?
I don't know.
Do the kids not use PayPal?
The kids all seem to like Venmo. Want Venmo. I think the kids like Venmo.
Do I have to put something new on my...
Your phone does not want to take anything new. Right
my
now.
Phone is... Do I have to have Venmo on my phone? I don't like things on my phone. I like my phone on my phone.
You just want the jitterbug.
I just want the jitterbug telephone.
With the extra big buttons.
What I want is a landline again.
And a long cord.
On the wall with a 40-foot cord, and I can just go anywhere in the apartment.
So I says to him, I says. Anyway, so you watched The Old Guard.
It is about immortal warriors.
Yes.
I'll tell you something. Tell me, if you tell me, oh, we're going to see a movie today about a guy in 1860 or whatever who steals milk so he can bake things in the Pacific Northwest. I would say, sign me up for that movie.
Kind of film.
If you tell me Immortal Warriors.
Based on a comic book.
On a centuries-old quest, then I'd be like, no, I have a strawberry pan dowdy to make. I cannot. I'm sorry. I love you very much, but I cannot watch your dumb, dumb, stupid, high concept movie about immortal warriors. And then I watched The Old Guard, and it's really cool.
There you go. Mm-hmm. What happens when you hand a superhero script to a Gina Prince Bythewood?
Yeah,
for
Gina Prince Bythewood made this movie. Why don't you explain what it is?
So yeah, it is about, it's a squadron of people who are immortal, and they sort of realize their immortality at various points of history. They're led by Charlize Theron as Andromache of Scythia, who's been at this for millennia at this point. There's two dudes who are lovers for centuries, who first met as enemies during the Crusade. You've got Matthias Skinnerts. Is that how we decided how we say his name?
Every time my Belgian Tom Hardy movie boyfriend is in a film, this subject comes up.
Yes.
And I always go back to the video of him and Marion Cotillard
promoting Rust and
Bone, that movie they were in together.
Rust and Bone.
Rust and Bone. And I swear they were trolling the interviewer. Because he would say it one way and she would say it another, and then they would like correct each other and then flip, and I'd be like, y'all are just effing with us. I've heard it pronounced Skinnerts, Schoonerts, Schinnerts. I've everything. I don't know.
Let us know in the comments.
I say Skinnerts.
Yeah, because I've been going with Skinnerts.
That seems right.
Sure.
Anyway.
Anyway, he is part of this group. And at the beginning of the film, they almost set it up to where you think it's going to be one of those, we've got one last mission. Oh no, but it's a trap and it's a betrayal.
Right.
And obviously it's not a last mission because they're freaking immortal.
Right.
But they do a repeat job, which they usually don't do. They get hired by Chiwetel Ejiofor, but it's a trap and it's to expose them for who they are. So while they're on the run from him and trying to keep from being outed and discovered, and they're also being captured so that a big pharma company run by Dudley Dursley can do who knows what with their DNA, they discover in their dreams that they are about to be joined by another immortal, who is Kiki Layne's Marine, who has just had her throat slit in Afghanistan, but recovered somehow.
Right.
And just as everybody's starting to get kind of weirded out about that and wondering what her deal is, along they come to take her away and get them to join their merry band, which of course at first she is not down to do.
They are so not merry.
They're not really
I'll
merry
I'll tell you
at
a
all.
Thing. Let me interject just a little bit here.
They're a little merry.
They are unfortunately almost never merry, and their leader is the least merry of them all because she's tired of this life.
Well, yeah,
and she is just she's.
It's exhausting.
When Charlize Theron adopts, like, I'm going to kick you in the face as a character for a film, she's never going to crack a smile. There's a little bit of a moment when she's with her old friend Quinn early in the middle of the film,
yeah,
where they sort of like kind of smile at each other, and that's it. That's all you get.
No. Yes. There's a bit early on where they all get together. They haven't seen each other in a while.
I'd be upset too if I had to live forever and I could never have any fun.
And you know, like somebody gives her a piece of baklava and she's able to identify what part of the world it's from.
That like, is a my favorite scene.
There's a bit of respite early on before things start getting really like you know intense. But things get intense and they stay intense. And I mean, this is. It's Greg Rucka did the comic book. He did the adaptation and wrote the screenplay. And, you know, this is the a lot of what's cool about this comes baked in from the source material. The source material has a queer couple at the center of the action, has a black woman at the center of the action.
Yeah.
But to get that in a superhero movie and to get it directed by a great black female director like Gina Prince-Bythewood, where I think this is a first for any kind of major superhero movie.
Was this always going to be a Netflix
That
film,
I don't know.
Or was it going
I
to
think
be?
Maybe, but I'm not sure.
All right.
I don't know the full story.
Not that it really matters. Not because
at this point, it's moot.
Platforms don't matter at all anymore. Yeah. Like, we just reviewed House of Hummingbird.
Yeah.
That was just dropped into virtual cinemas and is going to be on Blu-ray in about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Like the promo version just came to our door.
Yeah.
And so the collapsing of time and the closing of movie theaters has made everything weigh the same to me.
And I think certainly when historically, when we look back at 2020 specifically, I think all movies are going to have a certain asterisk involved.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, this was produced by Universal or Warner Brothers, but it premiered on streaming platforms because, you know, 2020.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is a groundbreaking film in a lot of ways. And then just beyond that, it's a really effective one and a really fun one. And for a movie that is clearly a tentpole, like they do a lot of seeding for the other directions we could go in and other stories that we have to tell within this universe. It doesn't feel like that Marvel thing where all you're doing is looking forward to the next one. And the one that you're currently soaking in is like maybe interesting or maybe not. So it does in the same way that people point to like the Breaking Bad pilot to writers. Like, if you want to write a pilot, this is what has to be in it. And you have to like hit these points and establish these characters and lay this groundwork and create these stakes and all the things that a good pilot will do. This is how you do a tentpole movie as far as like plunging us into a world, explaining the rules of it, introducing us to the players, and then also coming up with strands that we can follow later if the audience decides that we get to.
Right. And in terms of, we're going to talk about this in terms of the superhero genre.
Yeah.
The one thing it has in common with other, you know,
comic book adaptations,
studio franchises, is a sort of self-seriousness that you pointed out the literal like three moments where no one is grim and
there's
angry.
A bit of levity. Yeah.
Yeah. So it does, that does feel like part of the stuff we've come to expect from superhero films.
There is humor, just maybe not in levity.
But where it diverges from that is literally everywhere else. There are human beings in this film.
Yeah.
They aren't creatures, they aren't costumed, they are folks who have learned that they have this weird thing about them. And it keeps them alive for thousands of years. And to that end, they have to go out and try to make history into something better than it might otherwise be.
Yeah.
Again, you mentioned that there is, you know, one of the leads is a black woman. two of the other leads are gay male characters who are a couple.
One of whom is a Muslim.
One of whom is Muslim. And it leads to my second favorite scene in the movie, because baklava is always number one, where they are captured
yes.
by some a-hole brute soldiers.
The aforementioned alpha males.
Exactly. And when the actors' names are Marwan Kenzari and Luca Marinelli.
Yeah.
When Marwan Kenzari is insistent on trying to find out if his man is okay.
Yeah.
One of the soldiers says, "What is he, your boyfriend?"
Oh, the monologue.
And the response that he delivers, it's like 30 seconds?
Mm.
It made my heart fill up in and made my righteous sort of queer indignation about every hideous human being I've ever met in my life who didn't want any part of me because I was queer.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing moment.
Yeah.
In this film.
It's going to be in queer nerd weddings from now on, I think.
Oh yes. It totally will.
It's so good.
We'll get sick of it.
Yeah. Enjoy it now. It's going to become a cliche.
It's because pure
it's,
now.
Because it's so wonderful and it's going to be quoted so much.
So there's also that.
Yeah.
But then there's the other thing that I love. And it's the understanding of how their meddling in history.
Yeah.
Is, in the words of Qubitel Ejiofor, is exponential.
Yeah.
The effect is exponential. And it's like at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, when when George Bailey asks Clarence, like, well, where's Harry? It was like, well, Harry died that day, because you weren't there to save him.
All the men on that transport died,
because Harry wasn't there to save them. And when you see that part in It's a Wonderful Life, you're like, oh. And then you learn all the things that they affected.
The ripple effect.
And yeah. And you're like, okay, that's actually really cool. So, yeah, I'm super into this.
Yeah. We should get the comics. I would like to read the comics.
I don't care about reading the comics.
I knew you had a limit. Anyway. Yeah,
I got
you're good.
I got things I got to do.
Okay, fine.
Talk about Carmilla.
So Carmilla is one of many, but the latest, adaptation of a novella by Sheridan Le Fanu, of a story that is considered to be really the OG vampire story. It came out about a quarter of a century or so before Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. And this version, I mean, it has been filmed in different ways with different agendas. I think for a while there, it was sort of like the way to get lesbianism into a mainstream movie was, oh, well, they're vampires, you know?
Yes.
This one is the lead character, a girl named Laura, lives in this sort of, you know, fancy British estate house. They're kind of off on their own. They're in the country. Her father is a widow and a doctor and is fairly distant. She's mainly being raised by a fairly humorless governess. And so, you know, there's
Miss Fontaine.
There's already a lot of repression going on. And
here's a good example.
Laura's left arm is tied
Laura
down.
Laura is left-handed.
Yes.
And so her arm is, every morning, bound behind her back.
Yes.
Because the left hand is the devil's hand.
Of the devil. The sinister hand.
Yeah.
So Hannah Ray plays Laura. Jessica Raine plays Miss Fontaine. And, one of the highlights for Laura is that this other girl is supposed to come visit, and then she dies mysteriously, and then soon thereafter, another girl shows up after a carriage accident, And she claims not to remember her name, and so Laura dubs her Carmilla. She's played by an actress named Devrim Lingnow, who has an otherworldly beauty about her.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just that she's...
An otherworldly everything, yeah. Really. Yeah.
I don't know if it's just that she's very not British and everybody else in the movie is super British.
Right.
But nonetheless, she appears like she beamed in from another world of glamour. Not that British people aren't glamorous, but the ones in this movie are decidedly not. Anyway, so both Laura and Carmilla appear to be, you know, like 13, 14. They're very much, you know, pubescent, I think would be the word. And they grow very close together. It's very whispery and touchy and, you know...
Oh, it's real touchy.
White linen nightgown sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so it very much reminds me of, like, Picnic at Hanging Rock or Heavenly yeah. Creatures.
Yep.
These sort of, like, young girls discovering themselves.
Feverish.
And, exactly. And, you know, Carmilla, of course, has secrets that will be unlocked over the course of the film. This is a very swoony movie. I like it a lot.
It is... It downplays the act of vampire seduction by presenting you with a young protagonist who is already drawn toward dark things.
Yeah, like she's always stealing her father's anatomy textbooks.
So she can look at bodies being cut open and stuff like that. Holds her hand over fire to see how long she can last. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
So... It's really just a stroke of good luck that another teenage lesbian vampire showed up to help her move her life along.
Fulfill her destiny. And this is written and directed by Emily Harris, who also, like, surrounds these two girls with, like, nature that can be either, like, ethereal and gorgeous or, like, burrowing earthworms with really sounds on the soundtrack.
Right. It reminded me quite a bit of Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights, which is this very mud-based retelling. And I loved it. And
you know, the Brontes, but with more mud.
So, like, if Andrea Arnold directed a very slow, broody Hammer horror movie in 1963 or something...
Or a Hammer horror movie. They were all slow and broody.
Where, like, the first hour, almost nothing happens.
But you get lots of shots of the castle hallways.
Yeah. And I am so into that kind of thing.
Mm.
I've said it before in a way that I think people think is insulting, but, you know, I do love a good old boring Hammer horror movie.
I was never bored by this one.
And I don't mean it in that way. Yes, it's atmospheric rather than eventful.
Exactly.
And so, and then they do everything but have teen lesbian vampire sex. There's some blood makeouts and it's
intimate.
Horny. And so I think this is very cool.
Yeah.
And you should investigate this film.
Yeah.
All people, not just teenage lesbian vampires. But if you are one,
at top of the list,
then it moves right to the beginning of your queue. We watched Flannery,
yes,
the Flannery O'Connor documentary. And if you don't know who Flannery O'Connor was, perhaps you remember, or maybe you don't. If you're older, you might remember reading a story in your high school English class called A Good Man is Hard to Find, about a family from Georgia who takes a road trip down to Florida where they are met by a serial killer named the Misfit, who murders them all one by one, the end. And
it was definitely in my 11th grade anthology,
it was.
10th grade.
And what you learn in the documentary, and this is not the point of the documentary, but what you learn in the documentary is that Flannery O'Connor's highly accurate observational qualities of the American South during the Civil Rights era of the 50s and 60s meant that her white characters often used language that is highly offensive.
Yes.
And therefore, what you learn in the doc is that she has, her work has fallen out of curriculum.
Yeah.
Curricula. Because of that language. But if that, you know, is what's taking place, mm-hmm. You know, a uniquely modern voice, you know,
yeah.
of mid-century, you know, America speaking specifically about the South.
And not uncritically.
And no, like deeply critically.
Yeah.
you know, will not be heard about by people.
Mm.
That kind of bums me out. So here's who Flannery O'Connor was. She was devoutly Catholic.
Yes.
She was born in the 20s. She always wanted to be a writer. She died young. She had lupus. She died at age 39.
She originally wanted to be a cartoonist, which yes. I did not know.
Yeah. Much of her career was spent on a dairy farm in Milledgeville, Georgia.
Yes.
Because she was, you know, unable to travel because of her illness.
But she, you know, did the writer's program at Iowa. She went to the retreat at Yaddo. Like, you know, she was very much becoming a presence in the literary world
yes.
when the disease happened. And then from her family's home was able to, like, continue to be published and write novels and short stories.
She wrote the novel Wise Blood. But primarily she was known for her short stories.
Yeah.
One collection is called A Good Man is Hard to Find. The other is called Everything That Rises Must Converge. She also wrote lots of letters and essays, all of which have been collected.
Yes.
And one of the things that she was so intent on was writing about the dark side of humanity.
Yeah.
And how that related to the mystery of faith. And also, again, she was like a reporter when it came to cold-eyed clinical observation of white racism and the structure of racism in the South. Now, what you learn in the film, to a small degree, not to a great degree, but what you learn in the film is that she was part of her world.
Yeah.
She was part of her time. She had racist attitudes that didn't get a lot of play.
In the film, not so much.
And not even in the world of literature. You know, yeah. she has biographers and, you know, critical voices who have sort of downplayed things that were always there in the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read a lot of the letters, but I haven't, I never encountered the stuff she said about, for example, James Baldwin.
Yeah.
She had the opportunity to meet him. She declined. She knew that she couldn't do it in the South and still maintain her
invisibility,
anonymity yeah. in terms of her ability to go around and listen to people talk.
Right.
She said, I could meet him in New York, but not here. And so that's not a problem, really.
Yeah, you can but then, see the logic there.
Here's something that's not in the film, but that's in a New Yorker article recently, where mm-hmm. she said, well, I don't like James Baldwin necessarily because he agitates.
Oh,
yeah. yeah, and I'm like, oh, ma'am, what? Where did you write
Miss
and
O'Connor.
Say this? Yeah. You know, she was pro-integration
yes.
As a way forward for the South, but not for herself personally.
Mm.
So that sort of thing has been very recently brought to light.
Right.
And
the movie very shrewdly when...
The movie very, very delicately handles this by allowing Hilton Als and Alice Walker to talk about it.
Yes.
In ways that I don't think are like cop outs
no,
at all,
but forgiving.
But they are forgiving of that moment, and they are understanding of that element of her
yes.
life,
yes.
that very real element of her life. And so everything, as a huge Flannery O'Connor, you know, fan, this news is new to me. Like, it's been about 3 weeks or 4 weeks since the New Yorker article was published, and you sent it to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I read the whole thing immediately, and I thought, oh, what to do with this information? You know? And the answer is, you have to sit with that. You have to make room for that in your understanding of this person whose work you greatly admire and whose work was part of pushing the South forward.
Yeah.
Like, so she did this good public outward-facing thing while maintaining sort of inwardly the racist attitudes that were handed to you like oxygen if you were born in Georgia in the 1920s.
Right. Again, the movie does not delve nearly as deeply into this as we are.
No, we're completely digressing from the film right now. This is not so much part of the film.
Yeah.
The film is a PBS documentary about the life and work of Flannery O'Connor and how great she was. And to that end, it is a perfectly good documentary about that subject. It's informative, it's entertaining, and if you don't know anything about her, you will want to go read her work. And you should, because it's important. It's really, really astonishing work.
And when Dave says PBS documentary, he means that literally this was produced for American Masters.
Yes.
It was getting theatrical. It is now.
It would have gotten a couple weeks in big cities.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is streaming in the places where things stream. You know, in LA, it's on the Lemley Theater site. Like, check your local art house cinema. It will be on American Masters within a year or so.
Yeah. But what I'm getting at by the digression about this New Yorker article is, I read the article before I saw the documentary, and I sat through the documentary thinking,
what are they going to say?
Are they going to say? Are they going to talk about it? Is it going to go there like the New Yorker article does? And they kind of do.
Yeah.
But not all the way, because people have a really hard time holding two thoughts in their head at the same time. All people have a hard time doing this. Everybody, me, you, everyone we know.
Yes.
It's rough out there when you learn that the person you thought was so great has a part of them that's not so great. And that shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody about anyone.
Yeah.
You know?
Certainly,
like,
any artist.
If you admire someone for the work they do, and then you get to know them as a person, and you're like, oh, wait, there's this one part of your personality that's flawed or damaged or wrong, and you have to adjust yourself for that person. You have to adjust your mind for that person if you want to keep them,
right?
You know? And it's up to everybody individually who they're going to keep and who they're going to not.
Sure.
Like watching the Hannah Gadsby first stand-up special, where she was like, you know what? I don't need Picasso. And I remember watching it thinking, but what if I do? How do I still
reconcile,
admire Picasso and know that he was a monster to like every woman that he ever met in his whole life?
Right.
I'm still trying to sort that one out.
No, obviously. And I always say that it's easier when they're dead.
Much.
You know, you don't have to deal with the reality of this person existing. You don't have to feel like you're putting money directly into that person's pocket.
Right.
Like, there's all these
all
these walls come up when the person is dead and they're sort of safely part of history.
Right.
You know, and maybe that's facile, but that's one thing that I've found a way to get me through the ongoing art v. the artist argument.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been going on for, well, it's been going on forever, but recently it's been going on much more
prominently.
Publicly and prominently. And so, you know, is Flannery O'Connor the most important religious-based writer of the 20th century in the United States? Yes, she is. Because if you are a person who, you know, grew up with any religious, upbringing at all, you will recognize your life in her work. Even though it was written, you know, 70 years ago. But
and I think her brand of Catholicism, like, she would have been very at home in Spain.
For real.
Spain is so down with all of the bloodiest Catholicism, the most sort of like, you know, tumor-based Catholicism. Like, it gets grim. And she's right on that page.
But but also, again, going back to the subject of race, as a writer about the changing South.
Yes.
She was merciless and pinpoint accurate.
She called it as she saw it.
About the way white people behaved as the earth shifted under their feet.
Yes.
And their resistance to that earth shifting under their feet.
Yes.
And their spiritual desolation when they learn that they're the villains of history.
Right.
And that the world that they were handed is a villainous world. You know, she covered all of that.
It wasn't theirs to be handed.
Yeah. So, again, I'm 3-4 weeks into learning this new information about her, which I guess means I have to go back and read The Habit of Being to see where that in the book it is. Mm. It's like right behind me on the bookshelf.
Yeah.
Like, where are those passages in those letters? Because I don't remember them. Mm. Either I blipped over it or I didn't get to that part because I haven't read the whole thing because it's right. 4,000 pages long. She wrote a lot of letters, you guys.
She did.
Her letters were her relationships.
Yeah.
They talk about that very deeply in the film.
Yes.
Everyone she knew, she corresponded with.
And her letters
she couldn't visit them.
Her letters and her prose in the doc are all read by Mary Steenburgen.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a fascinating movie. She was a fascinating person. You should also be reading Zora Neale Hurston.
Yes.
And you want the black perspective of the American South.
Absolutely.
The film is called Flannery. You should watch it.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're not dying to watch it immediately, it'll be on PBS.
It'll be on PBS.
Before you know it.
Pretty soon. Okay, so the least talked about film of the week.
Yes.
And by that, I mean, I haven't heard anyone else talking about this film this week.
I saw somebody on Twitter or Facebook reference it in like a list of stuff that he had watched over the past week.
Yeah. It was a film that was new to me. During this unprecedented time, the way we decide what films we're going to talk about on the show and what films we're going to talk about when we go to KCRW, like we did last week on Friday, is you gather up your stuff with breakfast all day and you bring me, you know, titles, and then I go...
I get a lot of press releases still from publicists.
I still also get a lot of press releases from publicists, but quite often they're films that I just don't think are worth talking about. Like, I know I haven't seen them yet, but just reading what they are, you get a sense over the years. You know, I've done this for 21 years now. So you get a sense of, is this important? Do I care? And so what I often do is I make the rounds. I go to the local art house chain, Lemley. Mm-hmm. They have a virtual cinema, and they have a thing. Here's what's coming.
Right.
You know. Lumiere, here in town, an independently run art house theater, they don't have a here's what's coming, but they show you what's up on a Friday.
Sure.
You know, what's new. And both of those theaters are places where something like First Cow might show there. But quite often it's going to be something even tinier with less, you know, marketing budgets. And so I go to Cinema Guild, I go to Grasshopper, I go to Lemley, I go to Lumiere, I go to Film Forum site in New York, I go to Lincoln Center's site.
You should start going to Outfest.org. They've been doing a lot of virtual stuff
lately.
I'll
start going to Outfest.org as well. But that's how I find out what's coming.
Yeah.
So I'm on Lincoln Center's site, and this film called Mayak, that I've never heard of, pops up. It's open. It opened just this past Friday on their virtual cinema. I think it's like $6 or $7. It's not expensive to stream it. It's a re-release. It is a restoration of a 2006 Armenian slash Russian film from a filmmaker named Maria Sakian. Mm-hmm. It was her first film. She was 27. And it was the very first film by a female director to come out of Armenia.
Feature film.
First feature film, narrative feature film, to be directed by a woman.
Yes.
In Armenia.
Yes.
She lived in Russia, but she was from Armenia. She left in the early 90s with her parents because of the war.
Right.
Civil war going on there. And that's what this film is about. It is I can only imagine it's at least somewhat autobiographical.
Yes. Made in 2006, but set in the 90s.
Made in 2006, set in the 90s, restored from not an original negative because they lost the negative over the years. Restored from a print. So you get, it's a beautiful, you know, restoration, but you get some of that scratchiness in the film stock. It is, if you were around in 2006 and you were at major film festivals where it played like Cannes and stuff like that.
Yeah. I think the Rotterdam Festival sort of spearheaded the restoration.
Yeah, and it was the English title is The Lighthouse. So if you recall a film about war in Armenia from 2006 called The Lighthouse, this is it.
Yeah.
It's not the name of a person. It means The Lighthouse.
Yes.
So it's about a young woman who returns home from Russia. She leaves Russia. She goes to Armenia. The village that she grew up in is, you know, blasted to pieces, but all the old people are still there. Mm. There are no young men. It's all old women and her grandparents. And she goes there with the intention of trying to get them to come with her to Russia.
Back to Moscow.
She doesn't want them in a war zone.
Yeah.
That's the entirety of the plot. I won't call this an experimental film, but I will call it an oblique narrative in that
plot is not what they're really down to.
That's not really what she's communicating here. You know, the young woman does go to her village. She does reestablish her connection to the daily comings and goings of people, mostly sort of the daily toil of chores, funerals, and relationship with her grandparents, who she tries to get them to come with her. I won't spoil what they do, but largely this is a film about the texture of village life as the village is being destroyed. It's about the memories that you bring with you and through which you see your home.
Yes.
In ways that, by virtue of necessity, soften that experience.
It is a war movie about the people on the margins of the war.
And it's a war movie that begins and ends with people dancing, which is not what you expect. It's very atmospheric. It's very dreamlike. She has flashbacks of memories. She has dreams.
It's about the idea of home and how it is that in wartime, refugees are created and what refugees are sacrificing by becoming refugees. That by divorcing themselves and distancing themselves from this area, this place that is theirs,
where they could die at any moment.
Yes, but still, it is familiar and it is home and it is the place that they have created for themselves over the years. And so leaving that is a situation that is so extreme that you have to be pushed past a certain level to which it's no longer tenable to stay in that place that has such a strong hold upon you.
If you are, you know, in the pot of water when it's cold.
Yes.
And it gets hotter and hotter and hotter, you might just stay. And that's largely what she encounters.
Yes.
Old people who are like, nope, we're good.
Yeah.
We're fine.
Leave here? What? Where would
and
I
go? Yeah, and go where? And she's like, well, you would go with me. there's another place where there's not a war happening right now. This is, again, like I say, this film's relationship with narrative is tenuous. You will have to leave that expectation behind as you're watching it.
Be okay with not always knowing when it is.
Right.
Because this is so focused on memory.
And her interior life.
Yeah.
As she's experiencing it versus how she experienced it as a child.
And because it's a, you know, it's a crumbling village with a lot of old people, you don't have like, oh, the fashions or the hairdos or something to go by. Every, you know, decades pass and the old people in the village always look like the old people in the village. And the village always looks like the village.
Right. Know? Right. This is really, really beautiful film, and I'm so happy that we, you know, stumbled on it. I don't know where it's going after its virtual cinema week at Lincoln Center. It may pop around to other places. You can go look at it at filmlinc.org right now.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend it. It's just moving and beautiful and just deeply, deeply mournful about the things you lose as you try to keep a hold of them in your adult life.
And it has the added pointing to the fact that the filmmaker passed away.
She did die 2 years ago. She had cancer. She was 37.
Right.
She made other features after this. I haven't seen them, but I would like to look at them now. Yeah. So, yes. High recommendation. Mayak. M-A-Y-A-K.
Indeed.
Filmlinc. L-I-N-C. Filmlinc.org is where you find it. So.
So, for DVDs this week,
what you got?
I wanted to spotlight three new releases from the Criterion Collection.
I'm going
to
let you do that. Why are you doing this?
Well, it's a long story.
I'll tell the short version.
Okay.
You have written a physical media column called DVD Obscura for years now. You wrote it for Movies.com.
Mm-hmm.
Then you moved it over to The Wrap.
Yes.
And now it is on The Spool.
Correct. TheSpool.net.
TheSpool.net. And there also happened to be a Criterion column about physical media on TheSpool.net already. So when you moved it over, you didn't quite know that.
I did not know that.
And now you sort of are like, you're getting Criterion products sent to you for the purposes of this column. But they already have the Criterion column.
Right.
So I thought we thought it would be a cool idea
to talk about it here.
Bring it here.
Since it's not going to be in my monthly.
So this
DVD
isn't an
column.
Ad for the Criterion Collection. No. But, you know, your critics were given free product.
Yes. But we dig what they do, and we're happy to talk about
it. Oh, we love them.
Yes. And right now, and again,
Who doesn't love the Criterion Collection? Is there a person who cares about film that doesn't love the Criterion Collection?
I have seen some critiques about, hey, why aren't there more films, you know, directed by women in the Criterion Collection?
There need to be more of those.
And yes, certainly, I think
they should get on that.
There's everybody's got room for improvement.
Yes.
All of the distributors, all of the production companies, all the film festivals, everybody get better.
Do you have a list? Do you want me to hold up these titles so that you can remember them as I hold them in my hands?
It's fine. I've got it written down as well.
All right.
Okay. You know, also right going on right now, and again, this is not an ad, but the semi-annual, I don't know how often they do it, the Barnes & Noble 50% off sale is going on. So if you
talked about that last time.
Right. Well, just a reminder, you can go to bn.com. And you can get these movies I'm about to talk about and pretty much everything else that they've got. If it's in store, if it's in stock, they will sell it to you for half off. So for the Criterion Collection this month, there is Preston Sturges' The Lady Eve, which is one of the great comedies ever.
It's so good and also is connected to me personally.
I forgot about that.
Because Going on 20 years ago now.
Yeah, it's been a while.
We saw it at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Yes.
On their outdoor screening series that they've been doing forever now.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there watching the movie, and our friend Vinny was with us.
The film stars Barbara Stanwyck as a con artist and Henry Fonda as the adorable, rich dope that she set her sights upon. But Henry Fonda's father is played by legendary character actor Eugene Paulette.
Correct. And there's a scene later in the film where Eugene Paulette is demanding that someone bring him his breakfast. And he's clanging...
Those silver domes they put on top of
rich people's food.
Yes. Yeah. So he goes to the table, lifts them up, and they're all empty.
And he starts clanging them together, saying, "Where's my breakfast? Where's my breakfast?"
In his signature froggy voice.
And so Vinny's sitting next to me, and he nudges me, and he goes, "That's you." And I was like, F you, that's you. How about that? And from that moment on, he began impersonating me. He began
via Eugene Paulette.
When my name would come up, he would do this combo impersonation that was half me and half Eugene Paulette. And it stuck. And it caught on. And all of our friends decided, oh, it was so funny. So very funny all the time to impersonate me. Badly, I might add.
Of course. Yes.
Badly, very badly, all of them. All the time. That was nearly 20 years ago. That is my connection to the Lady Eve.
Yes. Well,
all my friends are jerks.
Be that as it may.
And big stupids.
Be that as it may.
And cannot do a proper impersonation of me because I'm too beautiful for that.
There is sadly not a DVD extra about Eugene Paulette sounding like Dave White, but there's plenty to be found there. There's an audio commentary from 2001 from film professor Marion Keane, an introduction from 2001 by Peter Bogdanovich, a new interview with Tom Sturges, Preston Sturges' son and biographer, a new video essay from David Cairns, an essay from Jeffrey O'Brien, costume drawings by the legendary Edith Head, for Stanwyck's outfits, the Lux Radio Theater version from 1942, also featuring Barbara Stanwyck. So yeah, Criterion, and of course, you know, like a great 4K digital restoration of the original film. So there's that one. There is Marriage Story, and I love the fact that these Netflix movies are getting Criterion releases. They did Roma a while ago, and now they're doing Marriage Story, because... You know, yes, these movies were made by Netflix. They're going to live on Netflix forever. But, you know, you want, for the really good movies, you want the Criterion version where it's got all of the extras. And there are tons on this one. In addition to a 4K transfer, there's interviews with cast members and with, you know, Baumbach and, you know, the film's editor and production designer, costume designer, a new behind-the-scenes documentary. Yes, there's a Laura Dern.
Laura Dern.
New interviews with Rainey.
Laura Dern.
New interview.
Just everything, Laura Dern.
A new interview with Randy Newman about the score. Lots of cool stuff about from that one.
Yeah.
And then the biggie for this month is the... do pass me that one.
You talked about it last week.
I know, but I want to remind people
about
it.
You want to talk about it again? All
right. I do.
Oh, okay. All right.
The Bruce Lee box set. This is, you know... I love a box set.
He didn't make a lot of movies.
The
ones he made were groovy.
I love a shelf with big, elaborate DVD boxes. They don't have to be shaped like Jamie Foxx's head as Electro or anything like that. But I do love a good completist. We've culled together these movies, even though they're from different distributors and different companies. But we put them all in one place because it's important that you have them all. So, yeah. So, this Bruce Lee box set... 4K digital restorations of all the movies, Big Boss, Fist of Fury, Way of the Dragon, Enter the Dragon. Oh, sorry, no, okay. 4K of Big Boss, Fist of Fury, Way of the Dragon, and Game of Death.
Yeah.
A new 2K of the rarely seen 99-minute theatrical version of Enter the Dragon. A new 2K of the 102-minute special edition version of Enter the Dragon. Alternate soundtrack, so you've got Mandarin language and English language, six audio commentaries. You've got the 1981 sequel Game of Death 2. You've got new interviews with Matthew Polly, who's one of the Bruce Lee biographers. New interview with an expert in the film company Golden Harvest. You know, like, yeah, documentaries and extras and interviews with Bruce Lee's widow, with his collaborators, including Sammo Hung. New English subtitle translations, an essay by Jeff Chang. So just everything you would want in one awesome collection. So Criterion is awesome, and they've got lots of great stuff this month. You should check it out.
And if you ever think you're going to impersonate me, maybe you should take a class in how to do that first.
But you're not bitter.
No.
And as also a reminder, we do have a Patreon. This is an ad.
This is an ad.
Patreon.
Ovid has abandoned us.
Yes. No, they're just, that ended. Patreon.com/linoleum.
It was a fling. It was a four-week fling.
It's a love that doesn't end. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. We bring you so much extra content and goodies and hangouts and things and stuff.
We're watching E.T. this Saturday night.
We are.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're somebody who likes this and you want more of this, then go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. We got extra shows and all kinds of just amazing things that only our subscribers get, and you want to be one of those subscribers, I think. Do we have letters?
Kathy. Kathy says, I loved Palm Springs. I am to romantic comedies what Dave is to World War II movies and Alonzo to Hallmark Christmas movies. Aside, I am also apparently the demographic Call of the Wild was catering to. I sobbed uncontrollably during about half of it. So dogs are my horses, I guess.
That dog wasn't even real. The Harrison Ford Call of the Wild? Wow. Okay.
But, you know what? If you loved it and it made you cry... Have it.
Every pot has a lid.
Have it. Have it. Love it.
Yes.
I'm so now past the point of like yucking a yum.
Yeah. Look, every movie is somebody's favorite movie.
I might hate something real hard, yeah. But if you love it, cool.
More power to you.
More power to you. Said Kate. Thomas says, I don't know if this is a bit weird, but I just wanted to thank the listener Victoria for the letter she sent in. Aside from being an important correction for you guys, it was also interesting, informative, and really got me thinking about some things in a different way. I know it's not the point of the show at all, but it's pretty cool that you two can essentially act as a vessel for perspectives from people in places we may not hear about otherwise. And for that reason, I just wanted to take a moment to thank Victoria for allowing all of us in on a conversation which may have never reached us otherwise.
Well, all right.
JD. Tom Hanks's age in Greyhound is very realistic. People don't realize how incredibly tiny the U.S. military was between world wars. Officers who joined the military in the 20s or 30s often could not get promoted beyond a certain rank because there simply weren't jobs for them. And they might not be able to leave either, as the Great Depression meant there weren't many jobs elsewhere. Many famous generals like Patton, Eisenhower, and Bradley weren't actually generals before the start of the war created opportunities for them. George C. Scott, at the beginning of Patton, is in largely the same situation as Tom Hanks here. It's just not something the film focuses on, and so nobody questions it. It only seems odd because of the way Hollywood deals with age, and Hollywood's biases color how we perceive our own history. For people reading the book in 1955, this would have been their life experience. I hadn't thought about that.
That is all totally valid, and I support this, except...
What?
Then why start the movie with him proposing to Elizabeth Shue?
Maybe he was waiting until he got a high rank before he...
That's a lot of waiting. That's a lot of waiting.
Listen, people were different then.
No, look. That is...
They had been a courtin' for 40 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You don't know.
They should be having this conversation like at their
oldest...
Maybe
he's a widower. And she also is a widow.
Then they needed to make that
maybe
clear.
Those that you don't know what's
they
going on.
They needed to make that
maybe
clear.
Maybe that's what happened.
That's a conversation that they should have been having at like their oldest child's Ivy League graduation. Beyond that, yes, good
fine.
Point.
No, but thank you. I had never thought about that before, but
And I think the movie could have
given us a line of dialogue explaining that.
He's just right into it.
Kids. Here's some facts.
You guys, the 1940s.
Yes, thank you very much. That was information that I needed to know.
No, that was illuminating. I appreciate it.
Now we're done.
We are done. All right. Well, hey, thanks for listening. Please go check out all of my other podcasts, won't you? Who Shot Ya on Maximum Fun.
Anybody write us a 5-star review lately?
Not lately.
Well, what's y'all's problem?
I'm getting to that part.
Get in there and do that. I'm itching for a new 5-star review. Right.
Check out Who Shot You on Maximum Fun. Check out Breakfast All Day and my latest new podcast, A Film and a Movie, on the Bramble Jam Network.
I was a guest on it today.
Yes. Dave's episode will be dropping next week.
Nepotism had nothing to do with it.
Absolutely. But go check out our current episode right now. Bibbs joins me and Dan to talk about the silent 1920 Mark of Zorro and Batman Begins. And then our new episode drops Wednesday. And it's Dan and me talking about Hitchcock's Rope and 1917. So anyway, give those shows a listen, won't you? Also, check out what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over the Critically Acclaimed Network. Listen to The Schmoes Know, Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Big Fat Gay Podcast, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts, where you should, as Dave mentions, leave us a 5-star review. You can also
Never speak to me again.
You can also, or my son, you can also leave positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, Castbox, Podbean, and so on. You can follow us. What?
I'm so stupid. Every time, I swear, like 2 years ago, you were listing off podcast.
You still think Podbean is funny.
I still think Podbean is funny, and it still makes me think of the time that I said Floop.
Yes.
Was one of the platforms.
So you're still laughing at one of your own jokes.
I'm still laughing at one of my own jokes. In my head, 2 years later, every time you say Podbean, I think, and Floop.
Well, the classics never die.
I'll never not think I'm very funny about that.
Someone must. follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. I think he just had a birthday, so go wish him happy birthday on Twitter.
Happy birthday, Blue, on Twitter.
At Bluetopia, BLEUTOPIA. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll come back and join us next time. And until then,
goodbye.
Wow, you sounded just like Eugene Paulette.
Shut up.